This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Last day of the week, last day of the month. And a lot of international stories we're looking at for their impact on the UAE. One's China, big state visit, what's come out of it. One's Russia, the UAE law firm that is opening up an office there. We speak to Dr. Habib Al-Mulla. One's South Africa, elections. We've been speaking live to Cape Town and to economists this morning to look at the knock-on effects of a potential change there. Plus, we've had new AI guidelines for the media and comms industry, having a look at what they mean, well, for the media and comms industry. And turbulence. IATA's got its massive AGM, its biggest AGM ever, actually, which will take place in Dubai next week. Turbulence and a new tool to tackle it are on the agenda. We're going to hear from the IATA regional boss, Kashif Khaled. Having a look at our top stories this morning. It's very much an international focus on the Business Breakfast today, looking at what is happening in the rest of the world and how it affects us and how we relate to it. Whether that is investments in Moscow, whether that is trade deals in China, or whether that is elections in South Africa.
Yeah, we've been looking at that because the election happened on Wednesday. Results are trickling through. And while we won't get the full results till this weekend, it already seems clear that the ANC will not get a majority. And it will be the first time that's happened since Nelson Mandela became president 30 years ago today. We've been getting some insight on this from various economists. Let's start in our own backyard. Khatija Haque, chief economist of Emirates NBD. Of course, she's based here in Dubai, but she is South African. And we've asked her to have a look at the potential significance of the South African elections and something, not completely, but something of a changing of the guard.
With over 50% of votes counted in South Africa so far, the ANC looks set to lose its majority after 30 years in power. Current projections put the ANC on track to win just over 42% of the vote, followed by the Democratic Alliance at 23%. The big question for markets is who the ANC might form a coalition with. An alliance with the DA would be seen as very market-friendly, but a partnership with the Economic Freedom Front or former President Jacob Zuma's MK party could see a shift to the left in economic policies that would be negative for investors and the economy.
Yeah, we do care about South Africa. We're not pretending that it is a tier one trading partner of the UAE. That's China, India, the United States and others. But it is significant. We have a big South African population here in the UAE, and there are ties between the two. For example, just a few weeks ago, South Africa's deputy president, Shipakoza Mashiteli, was here in the UAE, in Dubai, for a work visit, discussing trade ties in areas such as telecommunications and the digital economy. So we crossed live to South Africa earlier on today to Cape Town with the economist Yee van der Linde, senior economist at Oxford Economics Africa.
When we just heard President Ramaphosa speak, you know, he said that the economy has recovered to pre-pandemic levels. You know, that post-pandemic recovery has been awfully slow. You know, and in fact, if you look back over the last 15 years or so, the economy hasn't really grown at the pace it should be. I mean, it's sort of just north of 1% per annum, right? And, you know, ultimately, you don't have anything to show for it. You sit with high unemployment. If you look at GDP per capita over this period, it has actually, in real terms, come down. Investment in fixed investment to the country as a proportion of GDP has also declined. And I think it's, if you look for South Africa, investment as a proportion of GDP is among the lowest in the world. And so, you know, you sit with an economy that's stuck in this low growth trap. And the outlook looks quite dismal, specifically because of, partly because of incoherent policy. And, that doesn't boost investor confidence. And that's a big issue because everybody's sort of searching for the catalyst to improve South Africa's economic growth trajectory. And it's hard to see at this stage.
Yee van der Linde, senior economist, Oxford Economics in Cape Town.
Right, that's our look at South Africa. We've also got that visit to China, which has yielded a number of deals. Again, here is Khatija talking about those trade agreements and those business agreements between the UAE and China.
While there has been no detail released on any new agreements signed this week, China and the UAE are looking to improve cooperation in the energy and infrastructure sectors, as well as looking for ways to boost bilateral trade. One area in focus for improved cooperation is the high-tech industry, including the digital economy and AI, as well as clean energy. The UAE state visit this week also coincides with the China Arab States Cooperation Forum, which will see several other Arab heads of state attending as well.
There we go, Khatija Haque from Emirates NBD. Still to come this morning, we are going to hear from Dr. Habib Al-Mulla, one of the best known lawyers here in the UAE. He is moving to Russia. Well, not moving to Russia. He has moved some of his business to Russia and that he has opened up an office.
He has. Indeed, yeah. He says trade ties are strong already between the UAE and Russia. So they've got a lot of business. It's a big corporate law firm. And he used Mubadala as an example when he spoke to us. So we're servicing clients who are active in Russia. He made the point that the UAE does not have sanctions against Russia. He said it's only a few countries in the West that have sanctions against Russia. Most of the world does not at the moment. And therefore, they are opening an office there. And it was interesting that yesterday there was an interview in the Financial Times from Hamad Bouamin, who we've spoken to many times in his previous role as head of Dubai Chambers. He's now chairman of Dubai Multi-Commodity Centre. And he was making a very similar point, saying that there's a still active trade between the UAE and Russia, as there is between the UAE and Ukraine. But most countries, he made the point, again, do not have sanctions against Russia, and trade between the UAE and Russia continues. And he says Dubai in particular has benefited from that, as a lot of companies who are still doing some business in Russia have got a lot of people here. A lot of multinationals move their teams from Moscow to Dubai, for example, when the invasion happened in 2022. So that interview with Habib Al-Mulla, fascinating guy. I mean, if you're new to Dubai, you probably don't understand quite what a big deal he is in legal circles, but he is.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
So the law firm Habib Al-Mulla and Partners opening an office in Russia. Comments from the founder, Habib Al-Mulla, saying we are dedicated to supporting Emirati businesses and investments in the Russian market and beyond. He joins us now live on the line. Dr. Habib, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning to you, Richard.
So explain in your own words the rationale for opening an office in Russia.
Well, I mean, what we are trying to achieve is to follow where Emirati investments are going. And UAE and Russia has been enjoying a healthy trading relationship. I mean, for example, Mubadala has been investing in Russia since 2010. They have more than $3 billion US dollars investments. They have also another 150 million stake in the social media platform Telegram, 2.9% in the largest aluminium producer Rusal. In fact, the trade between Russia and UAE has increased by 60% between January and September 23 compared to the same period of last year. And this makes the UAE, in fact, the largest Gulf partner with Russia. Yes, things have been now to some extent slow because of the sanctions, but we expect that once the sanctions are lifted, the investment from Emirates to Russia, towards Russia, is going to just increase, and we want to be there ahead of the curve.
In terms of those sanctions against Russia from mainly Western countries, I'm looking at a headline, for example, on Reuters from earlier this month saying the United States and its allies press the UAE over Russia trade and sanctions, particularly dual use products. You know this story very, very well indeed. In general terms, what's your perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I think we need to realize that these are not United Nations sanctions. So they are not global sanctions. They are mainly, as you correctly stated, they are Western sanctions. And I think UAE has been, and many other countries, have been careful in how to apply these sanctions. We don't believe that opening an office in Moscow violates any sanctions rules. We, of course, look at each case individually. And I think many other entities are doing the same thing. So they look at each and every transaction, each and every partner that they are dealing with, whether it's a sanctioned group, whether it's not a sanctions group. I think there is quite a good, healthy line to continue doing business with Russia without violating any significant sanctions.
It seems there's something of a trend here. I was reading yesterday, I'm sure you did as well, an interview by Hamad Bouaman in the Financial Times. He's the chairman of DMCC and until recently was head of Dubai Chambers. And he said the following: the fact that the economy is not purely controlled by one side of the world makes these Russian sanctions less effective. He said, if we just take the Ukraine conflict, sanctions are effective when you look west, but they are not really effective beyond that. And I'm wondering, Dr. Habib, what level of coordination is there between you, a senior lawyer, high-profile business person, and others within Dubai Inc., if you'll pardon the phrase?
Yes, I don't think that there is any sort of coordination, but I think people try to understand how the wind is going, where the investment opportunities are, where are things going to happen. And anyone who can look into this, I think, will read to the same or a similar, I wouldn't say same, but maybe a similar conclusion. And I don't rule out that there may be other promotional entities, whether it's the trade or tourism, that will have also some sort of an existence in Russia in the coming few months, because everyone sees the prospects of doing business.
So, Dr. Habib, part of the business rationale for opening in Moscow is that there is already significant business activity between the two. And you mentioned Mubadala there as one significant example. But if we look at the pipeline of work that you expect to work on over the next 2, 3, maybe even 5 years, money going both ways, UAE to Russia and Russia to the UAE, how do you see that pipeline evolving?
I think it's going to increase. In fact, exports from Russia to the UAE has increased by 71%, reaching a high as $8.5 billion. There are, I think, more than 4,000 Russian companies in the UAE. We have seen an increase of about 34% in Russian FDI into the Emirates. So I think it's working both ways. And there are opportunities, whether we are talking about Russian businesses coming to the UAE or whether we are talking about UAE investments going to Russia. And yes, there are many law firms, in fact, even Western law firms, which have opened what they call Russian desks in Dubai. We thought that we need to take one step further, be ahead of the curve, take a more bold step, and be closer to our potential clients by opening the office in Moscow.
Finally, in terms of geographically, where do you think is next for Habib Al-Mulla? Obviously, your heartland is the UAE, Dubai and Abu Dhabi. You recently opened in Istanbul. Now you've got Moscow. When there's a map on the back of Dr. Habib Al-Mulla's office, where's the pin in that map or the potential pins?
Yes, I think we are going to open another office in a key Arab capital in the next, before the end of this year. We, in fact, have explored the market. We waited for this operation to finish and then we'll move to the next one.
Wish you the best of luck with that. Thanks very much indeed for joining us today. Really appreciate it. The thoughts
Thank
there
you.
Of Dr. Habib Al-Mulla. He's the founder of Habib Al-Mulla and Partners.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
April air passenger traffic globally up 11% year on year, 16% for international travel. That's ahead of the summer. We're joined by Kashif Khalid, who is the Regional Director for Middle East and Africa at IATA. Kashif, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, those numbers are not coming off a quiet 2023. How full are our planes at the moment?
Well, quite full. As we recently released our April traffic figures, you know, as you rightly said, demand is up 11% globally, but international demand is up nearly 16%. And then we're seeing, apart from both capacity increasing, we're also seeing that the load factors are rising as well. And within the Middle East region, we're pleased to say that it's up about 3.5 to 4% to nearly 80% utilization of our aircrafts in the region.
Is this still revenge travel or is this just some kind of new normal?
I believe this is the new normal. We have had some pent-up demand, but we are seeing more markets being connected or reconnected after the pandemic. And we're also seeing Asia Pacific both grow from a domestic perspective, but also for international travel. And that demand is very much there. And then many governments have liberalized their visa regimes as well, but also shifting patterns in trade and commerce are also driving a lot of that traffic as well.
So what does this mean coming into summer? What kind of forward bookings are you seeing?
In terms of May and June, we're still looking at about 12.5% in terms of increase for bookings and as well as ticket sales. So the summer looks like it's going to be extremely robust, again, driven largely by Asia Pacific, but also very strong numbers coming in from the European continent as well. And in the Middle East, both our airlines and airports are net beneficiaries of those trends.
Okay, you say extremely robust. I hear busy. Are airports ready to cope?
I believe so. I think, you know, the airports have learned a lot. I think the airports have added additional capacity. And then many of the airports have invested a lot in innovation, technology, as well as facilitating passengers. So I firmly believe the airports are ready.
Right. Well, this news obviously coming as industry leaders gather in Dubai for the annual AGM next week. Let's have a look at what might be on the agenda. Issues at Boeing. What kind of answers and actions do aviation bosses want there?
So obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about safety as well as recent trends and challenges we've seen with turbulence in the last couple of weeks. So in terms of the big ticket agenda, there's going to be, you know, obviously sustainability as well as our pathway to net zero by 2050, which the airline community has signed up to. But also safety is in focus, especially in emerging markets where safety records have yet to mature to the levels of OECD countries. But also how the airlines as well as the industry work together to alleviate some of those challenges. The importance of artificial intelligence in aviation is going to be a key focus, but also back to our basics of how aviation and tourism can work together to support economies and also the cargo industry as well. Those would be the big ticket items at this year's AGM.
You mentioned turbulence. Emirates coming out yesterday to say that it had joined the IATA Turbulence Awareness Platform. What's that?
So the IATA Turbulence Aware Platform is a program as well as a solution that we've designed at IATA to help airlines look at their pathways or where they're flying, how they can mitigate or avoid areas of turbulence, as well as share that information with other airlines that are flying in and around the same routes or around the same trajectory. And what it does is it gives airline pilots as well as the airline operations teams the ability to make decisions to go around areas where there might be high levels of turbulence.
Is this new or has this been in action for a while?
So within IATA, we've been working on this program for the last couple of years, but in terms of gaining adoption, most of our airline members are now subscribing and using this product quite successfully.
Is that after the last two incidents?
The last two incidents were just in the last couple of weeks. The program has been around for over 2 years, and most of the airlines that have subscribed are realizing the benefits. But I do believe there is an acceleration in interest after the last couple of incidents that we've seen.
Is turbulence getting worse, Kashif?
So the industry perspective is that, you know, there are some concerns around turbulence as a result of climate change. We are seeing different kinds of turbulence, both from traditional weather-related disruptions, but also clear air turbulence. And that's the one which is sort of hard to get a gauge or predict. But from a climate change perspective, we do believe that there will be an impact on turbulence.
What can the aviation industry do about that? I mean, obviously you've got your information sharing platform and more people signing up to it, but could it change, I don't know, the routes that are flown? Could it change even the way that aircraft are designed?
I do believe so. I think working with the OEMs, the airlines, first and foremost, there's great room for the industry to collaborate, to share information and data on turbulence, but also on the routes that the airlines use, enable pilots to be able to relay that information not only back to their operation centers, but also to other pilots in and around the region so that passengers can have a more comfortable journey on the routes that they've selected.
What about the way we behave when we're in planes? Singapore Airlines already making some changes to seatbelt rules. What do you expect to see from airlines in general going forward?
From a safety perspective, most airlines encourage and recommend that passengers keep their seatbelts loosely fastened. I think, you know, that's probably the strongest recommendation that we can give to the industry as well as traveling public, that while you're in your seat, please do keep your seatbelt fastened, because you never know when you might encounter areas of light or even heavy turbulence without much notice.
Kashif Khalid is the Regional Director for the Middle East and Africa at IATA. Dubai is going to host IATA's annual AGM next week. As he said there, there's a lot of big ticket items on the agenda. The great and good of the aviation industry will be here in town. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Time now for us to talk all things AI. Why? Because MEPRA, that's the Middle East PR Association, have released their AI guidelines recently. It was part of their latest leadership majlis down in Abu Dhabi. Joseph John Naylor is sits on the MEPRA Ethics Committee and contributes to that. Also discipline lead at the School of Media and Comms at Murdoch University. He's been kind enough to join us live in studio to discuss this one a little bit further. Joseph John, always good to see you. Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So before we get on to some of the guidelines themselves and some of the main points that have been set out, why the need to do this in the first place?
I think never before in history do you have a time when AI is making so much of an impact. According to the World Economic Forum, misinformation and disinformation is the most immediate threats to humankind right now in the next 2 years. And AI is just amplifying the whole threat. And it's essential that a communication body needs to have ethical guidelines. It's a framework of guidelines to help communication professionals, you know, navigate these increasingly muddled waters, as you may want to call it, because with the coming of Gen AI in the last 2 years, the kind of changes that we see, I think professionals do need some sort of guidelines to follow.
But isn't that the big challenge here at the moment, given how quickly AI is evolving and how quickly the sort of regulations around it are being forced to evolve as well? Is it difficult to give guidelines accordingly?
Okay, so the industry is all about celebrating innovation over caution and regulations. And sometimes ethics is always left to the end once the horse has bolted from the stables. So I think there's no better time. Now is better than never. The MEPRA AI team, we had people from Qatar and Saudi and UAE getting together and saying, we need some guidelines. And we had a lot of terrific professionals get together and say, let's decide on these guidelines.
Eight guidelines set out by MEPRA. We probably won't have time to go through them all, but I'm keen to have a look at a few of them. Number one is be honest and open. What does that mean?
Be honest and openness. There are two sides to it. When you look at companies need to decide and talk to their employees and say, are you using AI? People will be surprised to know as way back as 1 year ago in 2023, Samsung, Apple, Deutsche Bank, a lot of companies had a partial or a full ban on employees using ChatGPT at work and other Gen AI.
Yeah.
So if you are a communication professional, you need to come out and be honest to your employees and say, are you using it? How are you using it? Do you have a policy in place? And the second one, the material that you're giving the media is a Gen AI. Mm. You need to start labeling those. I mean, because it's a living document. I think the guidelines can never be absolute in concrete or stone. So I think these guidelines will keep changing as, the progress in Gen AI keeps evolving. The document will also keep evolving. So like you said, there's no absolute rules, but it's a giant step.
Point two is be responsible and credibility as well. Responsibility key here?
Yes, because there's a lot of AI material out there. People say there's a theory called the dead internet where they say, you know, bots, AI bots are filling up the internet with garbage. So technically, as communicators, we need to be sure that, you know, our voice is authentic. The material that we create is authentic and it's not Gen AI created.
What about the role of privacy as well? Point three is respect privacy.
Okay, so people forget that the information that you put into ChatGPT and all of these other Gen AI is being collected and harvested. And I think last year, Amazon found out a lot of the data was being reflected in the responses they were getting. So a lot of companies even today don't have policies telling their employees, listen, don't put in private and confidential information. And have a chat with your clients. If they say don't put our information out there, you shouldn't be putting out your information. And if it's a free service, you are the product. Your data is the product. There's nothing free. So,
what about the importance to fact check as well? Because obviously that's one of the tenets of journalism.
Of course.
Is you look to your sources. Are we too reliant on ChatGPT to tell us the truth?
I think we are. We've seen lots of examples where ChatGPT has created false examples and created facts and data where it never existed. So I think we still need the human intervention at the very top to make sure that the data coming out, especially when it comes to communications, because communicators play a very important role today in fighting misinformation and disinformation. they need to be checking the data that they're putting out there.
Point five, treat everyone fairly.
Yes, people forget Gen AI and all of these AI are trained on data sets through LLMs. So when you have these machine learning happening, you're going to get the biases that are reflected in the data input. So you'll already see cultural biases. You'll already see regional biases coming out in the data. It's very, you'll find there's a lot of data that is from the Western Hemisphere that's being fed into this, which may not reflect exactly the kind of content that we need in the Middle East and keeping all the sensitivities in the Middle East as well. So, you know, we need to be, again, human intervention, looking at this, upskilling our employees, upskilling capacity building for our teams and saying, listen, we need to go back and look at this and say, how best can we use Gen AI in our daily jobs?
Which sort of leads into another of the points that you make of keeping it real as well. How do you explain that?
I think people are smart enough to, I mean, today you can look at a document and clearly say, yeah, this is written by Gen AI. And if people are paying you and you're billing people for original content, I think it, you need to be transparent and say, look, we need to keep it real. You cannot have someone pinning the blame on a machine and saying the machine did this. You still need to have human oversight at the top and make sure that your company has process in place to catch any AI mistakes coming through.
AI by its very nature, technology driven as well. So interesting that one of your points is people driven. Think about people.
There's a huge rush to celebrate innovation and say, what's the new thing? I think companies need to realize people run companies. You need to upskill people. You need to train people who are in the workforce today. Don't think about the bottom line and start firing people just because, you know, AI can do it. Yes, there are new jobs coming in the future. People in the university that I teach, we're training them for new jobs of the future. But what about people today? How do they bring bread to the table? So think about your employees, you know, bring in the humane aspect of AI. That's what we're telling people.
And finally, what we've got less than a minute left. Keep learning and improving. What's this called?
This is, look, AI is changing every day. I think every morning when you wake up, you're going to see new things, new changes, new developments. So I think learning and development needs to be part of any company, irrespective of communications or not, and make sure that the staff and people are continuously trained and know the regulations of companies, I mean, of countries as well, because the UAE has a national strategy for AI strategy 2031. So, you know, keep yourself updated.
The importance of AI policies, obviously key at the moment. Use these guidelines if you haven't got one in place at work at the moment. Joseph, John, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
JJ, it's always good to see you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, working us through those points and also delivering on this latest AI guidelines courtesy of the Meet Protein. That's the Middle East PR Association. Joseph John Nellor is the Discipline Lead, School of Media and Comms at Murdoch University.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.